Hello, I'm your host, George Sanders, and this is Humanity Matters Most. This podcast is brought to you by the University of Houston College of Liberal Arts and Social Sciences, or CLASS for short. Humanity Matters Most offers a behind-the-scenes look at current research by prominent humanities and social sciences scholars. On this episode, CLASS Dean and former physical therapist Dan is speaking with Dr. Peggy Blake, who leads our Communication Sciences and Disorders Department. Together, they'll discuss Dr. Blake's research into how strokes impact speech and the theory of mind, and the unique challenges this poses for recovery.
Good afternoon, Peggy. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Good afternoon, Dan. It's great to be here.
Yeah, so we're here to talk about your research, and I want to congratulate you on the very large grant you and some collaborators recently received and have started working on.
Thank you so much. Yes, this one was a long time coming.
Yeah.
And so it's really excited to have the grant and now really be able to make some huge progress on these.
Right. Projects. And those types of grants are great. Not only are they resources for you to do your research, but they're also recognition for the university. It's sort of an external validation that it's what you're doing is that important that it's funded by the federal government. Mm-hmm. So congratulations again.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
So before we talk about the specific project, maybe we can orient people a little bit, and maybe you can just remind us with what is a stroke?
A stroke is caused when there's an interruption of blood supply to the brain. And the reason why this is so critical is because the neurons, the brain cells, aren't able to store any oxygen. And so they rely on a constant supply of oxygen through the bloodstream. So if there's an interruption to that, it doesn't take very long for the neurons, these brain cells, to start dying off. When they start dying off, then you get a whole host of different types of symptoms depending on where in the brain the stroke occurs. So for some people, they have motor deficits, they develop weakness or paralysis. Some of them have sensory deficits, others can have visual problems. What we look at most often in speech language pathology is when a stroke affects communication. So it can affect the ability to think of the words that you want to say or put those words into coherent sentences. It can affect the ability to understand words and sentences. It can affect the ability to express your emotions through how you say something. So we call it prosody, or kind of the melody of speech, and being able to express your emotions just through that intonation or prosody can be affected. And it can also affect your ability to understand what somebody else means as opposed to what they say. So many times when we're communicating, what we say isn't exactly what we mean. You know, we add some sarcasm, we add some humor, or, a knowing nod or something to let the person.
Yeah, the literal words aren't necessarily the message, right?
Right, yeah. Exactly. And so all of those different aspects of communication can be impaired after a stroke.
Yeah. And so I know that some of your research and your book talks about right versus left. Why is that important in studying this?
So the left side of the brain in the vast majority of people is really important for the kind of building blocks of language. So understanding words, understanding grammar and syntax, and being able to derive the meaning of words and sentences, and being able to express, find the words and put them into sentences. So within speech language pathology, we have known about this for almost 150 years. Mm. And the name for that disorder is called aphasia, when you have those problems with kind of the basics of language due to an acquired damage to the brain. The right side of the brain is really important for communication, but at a little bit different level. So the right side of the brain is really important for, again, understanding what somebody means as opposed to what they say. So after a stroke on the right side of the brain, someone may be able to understand words, they understand sentences, they can produce grammatical sentences, but the nuance of communication is lost. And they often have difficulty putting together all the different pieces of how we communicate. So normally when you're talking to somebody, you use the tone of your voice, you use facial expressions, you know, a raised eyebrows or rolled eyes if you're talking to your teenager, or, you know, the grin, the body language.
Yes.
All of those different pieces of communication, we seamlessly put those together when we're talking to somebody. But with the stroke on the right side of the brain, the ability to either read those extra cues or integrate them with the spoken message breaks down. And so these communication problems can seem subtle because the person is talking and responding and things like that, but they often have difficulty maintaining relationships. So if you think of the people you're close to, the friends, family, spouses, things like that, you communicate a lot through these subtle messages. And when you lose that and you either don't interpret what somebody is trying to tell you or you're not able to express yourself that way, it can be devastating for relationships, and it can be really hard to go back to work and maintain a job because you've lost that those interaction skills.
Right. So we probably all had this experience. And we say, for example, you learn to read somebody the longer you know them, right?
Right.
And I know that when I'm having our faculty meetings, for example, I can read the tone in the room by just watching the people. They don't have to talk.
Yes.
Based on what my message, whether it's positive or negative, you can see people reacting differently. So I think that's some of what you're getting at, right?
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
And so you're narrowing down to your current project, but your research in general a little more. Mm-hmm. I find it fascinating, this the concept of mind. Is that what it's called?
Theory of mind.
The concept of theory of mind, I guess, is what I was thinking. Yeah, the theory of mind thing, and then how it relates. Well, it's what your work, part of your work focuses on, and it's what this particular project, I think, it's a key element to understanding why you're doing that. So maybe you can speak to the concept of the theory of mind for a minute.
Sure. Theory of mind is the ability to understand that other people have thoughts and knowledge and feelings and emotions that are different from your own. And so, like in this conversation, I know that you know something about stroke from your background as a physical therapist. You've worked with people who have had a stroke and you've seen some of the communication problems. So I have a sense that you know some of the background information,
right.
But not the in-depth information about communication and some of the nuances of that. So when I'm talking to you, I can kind of gauge where to start the conversation. Since we're recording this for a broad audience, then I need to take into account that a lot of people don't really know what a stroke is. They may know it's something bad that they don't want to have, but not the details, and usually not the nuances of the communication issues. So we use theory of mind a lot in communication to know how much background to give somebody or to have a sense if you are considering bringing up a controversial topic that it might not go over well with everybody in the room, or there might be people who have very differing opinions. For in the broader picture, theory of mind has been talked about a lot in relation to autism spectrum disorder, where one of the issues with some people with autism is they don't have a strong theory of mind, and that interrupts their communication and interaction. So what we are doing with this project is looking to see if theory of mind can be affected by damage to the right side of the brain, as in a right-sided stroke. And so what we're finding is that acutely, so within a couple days of stroke, about 50% of these people with a stroke have a theory of mind deficit. And that's a huge
it's pretty significant,
percentage.
Right?
Yeah.
Half, right?
And compared to all the other disorders and deficits that we typically look for after right hemisphere stroke.
Right, so it's definitely not rare.
Right, right.
But not necessarily understood how common it is.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. There have been a handful of studies that have looked at theory of mind. One was back in the early to mid 90s. And then there were a couple about 8 years ago in Israel. And so trying to get more of a sense of how damage to the right side of the brain specifically affects it. And so what we are doing with this project is it's a longitudinal study. So we're testing people within a couple days of their stroke while they're still in the hospital. And then we follow them over a year. So we're going to test them again at 3 months and 6 months and then 12 months after a stroke. Because we have no idea if this theory of mind deficit will recover kind of spontaneously.
Just right. Like the other effects of stroke sometimes do.
Exactly.
They recover over time. The movements start to come back and those sorts of things.
Right, right. So as the brain heals itself, as the brain starts to rewire a little bit, and as the person goes through therapy, a lot of times they see a lot of improvement. And so with theory of mind, we don't know how it changes over time. And most of the therapies that we have in speech language pathology for this population don't specifically target theory of mind.
All right, right. So and this relates, there's a term, apragmatism, that's used in your research also that, mm-hmm. that relates to this. And so what is that the impairment of theory of mind? And then how would you like diagnose and potentially treat that? And I think some of your research is related to this, if I'm not.
Yep. Pretty much my whole career has been stuck on the right side of the brain and trying to figure it out, with the overarching goal of figuring out how we can better diagnose it and then treat it so that these individuals can maintain relationships and get back to work and be productive
citizens. Some of this may relate. I'm just thinking, so I think if you're in our age group, frankly, you have experiences that are both professional in our case, but also personal, where after some sort of an illness or an injury, people just don't quite see themselves.
Right. Right?
This is, I think, related to that. But it's hard, other than saying that, right, how does a clinician go about diagnosing this is what you're interested in, part of what you're interested in, yeah.
Yes, exactly, exactly. So with the label apragmatism, so that's a label that was generated by a group, we call ourselves the International Right Hemisphere Collaborative, and it started as a group of six of us, speech-language pathologists, clinicians and researchers from around the globe. There's a bunch from the US, some from Canada, some from Australia. And we decided that we needed a name for the communication issues associated with right hemisphere stroke. So with the left hemisphere strokes, the label is aphasia. Again, that's very well known, especially in speech language pathology, but in rehab in general. And the communication impairments due to damage to the right side of the brain have never had an accepted label. And so there's, you know, a wide variety of things that people call it. And it makes it difficult to communicate with other people. And it makes it really hard for patients and families to find any information about it. Mm. And so we decided that apragmatism was the label that that we thought was most fitting. It was actually suggested by another speech language pathologist about 20 some years ago, and never kind of took hold. So we kind of revived the label and then really created some structure around it and more carefully defined it. So apragmatism has to do with difficulties with the linguistic part or the words and how you construct sentences. So in apragmatism, this can look like selecting appropriate words, but maybe not the best word for the situation. So oftentimes they're not as, they don't convey enough emotion. Let's say it's a little flatter. Mm-hmm. So like when the James Webb telescope, the first images came back from that, and those are just stunning, amazing pictures.
Yeah, they are.
And someone with a right hemisphere stroke may say, "Oh, that's nice,"
right.
Or "That's pretty."
Right.
So it's partway
the
there.
Opposite of hyperbole, right?
It's, right, yeah. Right. Yes, exactly. So it's kind of flattened. They also, when they're talking, may tend to be more egocentric, more concrete. So less abstract, less emotional, kind of less depth to their communication. sometimes they can talk on and on and on and on. And as a listener, you're kind of like,
right,
okay.
I know people like that.
Exactly.
I've been told I may be one of those people sometimes. And these, what you're talking about right now, just to be clear, these are acquired traits after a brain injury, not the person's personality. So
exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So they weren't like that before the stroke, and this, they start to take on these characteristics after.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. But one of the things that makes this so challenging for the diagnosis is it is very hard to decide what is not quite in the range of typical, because there's such a broad range of typical communication. And so just going in and seeing a patient, you may think, oh, wow.
Right.
I couldn't get a word in edgewise, and I was supposed to be leading the session. And then you talk to their family and they're like, oh, did he talk your ear off again?
Right, right. And he's so, always been like that, right?
Exactly. Yes.
He's a professor.
Right, right. And so in contrast, again, to aphasia, where it's very clear if you have a literate adult, it's very clear when they can't find the words they want or they can't understand what should be communication at the level that they should understand. With apragmatism, it's a lot harder to identify it.
Right. Well, and this is a good point too, that because I know it's true in physical therapy, is people, not everybody moves the same.
Right.
But you as a clinician are just meeting them after they've been injured. And so you don't know what the pre-injury status was. And this is somewhat what you're getting at, which compounds. You may have to talk to more than just the patient, right? You have to talk to the family and try to get a sense of what is going on. But you're going into it. It's subtle. It may be subtle or not so subtle to begin with, but you don't know what the status was before.
Right.
Yeah. So that, I imagine that is a very challenging aspect of not only how do you define the diagnosis, but then how do you actually operationalize it in terms of the particular patient you happen to be working with right now, right?
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So with apragmatism, so there's three components to it. So there's the linguistic, the words they use, the level of communication, you know, if they change how they talk when they're talking to a young person versus an older person. Then there's the what's called paralinguistics, and that has to do with the tone of voice. So how do they express themselves? Do they change their tone enough so that you can tell when they're asking a question or versus making a statement or to convey emotion? And then the third piece is extralinguistic, and those are all the nonverbal cues. So facial expressions, gestures, body language. And for each of these, it's not only how they express themselves, but how they interpret what somebody else is saying. So somebody could be pretty good at expressing themselves verbally, but not pick up on the nonverbals from somebody else. And that's going to cause a communication breakdown.
Right.
So kind of any combination of not being able to do one of those well can be problematic. So those are the things that are subsumed under the label of apragmatism. So with my current project, kind of linking it, so theory
of
mind.
Yeah, so I was going to ask, so what are we going to learn in your current project that related to this?
So what we're doing in the current project, so we're looking at this theory of mind deficit and expecting that people who have challenges with theory of mind, it's going to impact their ability to communicate. So we may see aspects of apragmatism with someone
with the
theory of mind deficits. Right. Yes.
Great. So, you know, and maybe you can tell us a little bit about the study, and I'm sure there are challenges. Some of my research has been in clinical patient populations, people that are injured or ill. And I know some of the challenge there is it's not like you're taking healthy people and then randomly assigning them to groups and all of this. And they're a patient undergoing treatment, and you can't interfere with that. So studying it sometimes gets precluded by the treatment pattern that they're after, or they maybe need to change treatment for their, you know, to take the right path.
Yeah.
And so I'm sure there are a lot of complexities in this type of research. The other thing with stroke is not all strokes are the same.
Right.
So they may have multiple deficits in addition to the one you're interested in. So maybe you can tell us a little about like the design of your study. How are you identifying the right people? And then, of course, what are you studying and hope to learn, and how are we going to apply this and those sorts of, you know, what are the outcomes basically of the the study.
Yeah. So, yes, all of those challenges right. in working with patients. My co-principal investigator, Dr. Tatiana Schnur, is at UT Health Science Center. And in her position there, being in the med center, she's been able to get access to people right after a stroke, which is pretty unusual in speech language pathology research. And ours is already, just partway into it, the largest study of acute right hemisphere stroke that I know of. And so it's exciting, all the things we're going to learn from this.
It'll be impactful.
Yes, right? Yes. And so then with the study, what we do is, so within a couple days of their stroke, a trained speech language pathologist will assess them and do a theory of mind task. And that task has some control items in there to make sure that it's not an attentional problem. So they don't get it wrong just because their attention drifted. Or it's not a memory issue where they forgot,
right?
You know, what they saw, and then because of a memory issue, not a theory of mind issue. So there are some little controls built into the theory of mind task, so we can be sure that that is not the driving factor. It may influence it, but it's not the driving factor. And then we have a range of other tasks. We have a bunch of communication tasks. They retell the Cinderella story, so we can see how they create a story and are able to, you know, keep all the major parts
the key
to
elements,
it in there.
Right,
exactly.
Characters and plot and all that.
Yes. So we do that. They have a conversation with the speech language pathologist to look at the conversational exchange. Do they take turns well? If there's a miscommunication, is it repaired? Things like that. And then we have a couple questionnaires about their awareness of their deficits or any changes that have gone on, how the stroke is impacting them, what kinds of communication they find is challenging for them now that they've had a stroke. And we do those same questionnaires each time we see them, and all the language tasks again, so that we can look and compare what's going on. Are things getting better? Are they not? And, you know, also one of the things we're looking at is if there are patterns of deficits. So again, if they have a theory of mind deficit, do they have a communication or problem or apragmatism along with that? If they do have some attentional memory problems, do those people tend to have more deficits in this constellation of things that they can have? Then the other piece of it is that we're doing MRI scans to identify the location of the damage. And then we're going to look and see if these patterns are related to strokes in specific parts of the right side of the brain. And if we know that, then clinicians, when they go in to assess somebody, have something to help them prepare for it.
Right.
So, you know, if you know that a stroke that's further back in the brain tends to cause theory of mind deficits, then they'll probably want to make sure that they assess for that. If strokes more towards the front of the brain tend to impact how well somebody can express emotion through their voice, then you're going to want to make sure to assess that. Right now, with people with right hemisphere strokes, speech language pathologists pretty much are going in blind.
Right.
And,
and do everything that they, right. And
exactly.
So it helps to make the diagnosis in some sense too, right? You have some, if it's in this part of the brain, it's much more likely to be this type of impairment. And then you can focus your tests. You may still do a broad spectrum of tests. We often do that in physical therapy, but so if it's a lower, like their knee is hurt, right? You're going to do some standard walking tests, but you're also going to do things that are specific to the knee. So it'll be the same concept.
Exactly. So instead of trying to assess a little bit of everything because you're not sure what's going to be there, you can do some broad-based assessment, but then, like you said, some more focused based on what you think is you're going to find based on the location of the stroke.
Right. And of course, that helps drive the treatment plan then, so you're tailoring the treatment to the person, which is always the goal of healthcare for injured people. So how long is this going to go? When did you start and how long is it going to last, this study?
So we have funding for 5 years. So we started it last year and we had some pilot data, some patients that we had tested so that we could show the NIH that right. we knew what we were doing and we had this patient population. And so right now we have data on nearly 50 patients acutely, which again is enormous right. for this type of work.
Yeah.
And we still have, you know, 4 more years of recruiting and assessing.
Have a couple hundred people before this is all
yes.
all over with.
Yes.
And so that should be, you would hope, a broad enough sample to at least get close to, because there's all the nuances that you talked about.
Yes.
So severity of the stroke, mm-hmm. because again, it could affect other parts of their brain that affect other things, which compounds the complexity yes. of the problem, but it may also compound how they recover, basically, both the thing right. you're interested in and just in general. So ideally in these types of studies, of course, you'd have large samples to be able to cover all that variability, to be able to study more precisely the thing you're interested in, accounting for all these other factors.
Right.
So that's pretty impressive. 200 is big for any kind of a clinical study in my experience, it unless it's something that's like extremely common or done. Some of these large heart studies they've done at multiple medical centers and so on get very right. large samples, but for just a couple of investigators to be working on it, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, we're really excited about this.
Yeah, no, that's great. Anything else you want to tell us about the study?
So it's been really fun working with my co-PI, Dr. Schnurr, because she is coming from a cognitive psychology perspective. And she has many years of experience working with strokes on the left side of the brain and now with the right side of the brain. So looking at all these different aspects of communication and then bringing in her expertise in imaging, and it really makes this project so much bigger and better than what I could do on my own. And it's just been a really great collaboration, and it's nice to be able to take advantage of the resources in the Texas Medical Center.
Well, that's another great example of multidisciplinary research. You often learn more when you combine multiple disciplines. Studying within a discipline is important for advancing that particular understanding in that discipline, academic discipline or clinical discipline. When you start to combine, you start to see things from a broader perspective, and often it accelerates our learning. And yeah, University of Houston, of course, is a member of the Texas Medical Center. I've been collaborating for a long time over there, so that is a great partnership, and I think they would agree. The people I've worked with at the Med Center right. seem to think it's a productive discussion. But that a lot of my work was always collaborative. My joke is I'm a serial collaborator. I'm not sure I've done anything by myself ever. but I've learned a lot in doing that. Just the more right. you talk with people, the more you learn about different ways of looking at things, and it influences how you think about your own mm-hmm. problem. So
yeah.
All right, well, thanks for sharing all that with us this afternoon, Peggy. It's always great to hear about the research going on in the college. I wish I was more on the ground in that regard. But I definitely hear about the larger projects, and yours is one of them. So congratulations again on that.
Thank you so much. This has been a lot of fun.
Yeah, all right. Thanks.
That ends our episode. Today's episode has been produced by the College of Liberal Arts and Social Sciences and the Center for Student Media at the University of Houston. We'd like to thank the Department of Communication Sciences and Disorders for participating. Our team consists of the host and producer, George Sanders, producer, Lariah Smith, sound engineering from the Center for Student Media, and our intro and outro song was provided by Dizzy Gold. Thank you for listening, and if you'd like to learn more about our podcast or previous episodes, you can find us at www.uh.edu/class.